Dumb things. Today's Michaela Schifrin's birthday. For those of you that watch the Olympics, it's a happy birthday to Michaela Schifrin. Common, the rapper, who's a very, very well-known rapper, and Van Vleck is the is kind of like the father of modern metallic magnetism. It turns out, if you look up his history, but he's one of those physicists that won a Nobel Prize somewhere in their history. It's Donald Duck Day, Earmuff Day, and National Coconut Tort Day. Okay. So here are the distributions. I'll post these slides after I update them and add the things I'll draw at least. This gives you a feeling for the distribution. It was clearly too long of a midterm. I'm sorry. I remember everybody here, you know, being here quite a while on Thursday when we all took it. So I always, whenever I teach an upper-level undergraduate course, just like teaching a graduate-level course, it's a very similar curve kind of thing. Don't expect to be held to 90, 92, 84 type curves on these things, because it's not straightforward material. Average in RMS among the class, since we had, you know, 8 or 9 people taking the exam. Available points versus the average in the RMS. I do this to try and see, is there one problem that clearly killed people, right? And if anything, oddly enough, it was the first problem that I very nearly told everybody would be on the exam that seemed to be the worst performing problem kind of on average, even though, you know, the RMS, you know, perfect score was 2 sigma, away from the standard, the mean of the distribution for that particular problem. The same for problem 3. Overall, it was not unusual, I'd say. It was not an atypical distribution. But if I had to assign grades just based on these points and how I weight towards the final grade, you know, these are kind of the cutoffs, and you can see that there are 6-point differentials each between each one of those. And that produces a pretty flat distribution all the way down to the highest and the lowest scores. The highest score, I think, was like a 46 or a 47 out of 55. So that means it was not a completely killer exam, although it was tough because only a couple people got above 44 on it. Does anybody want me to actually, like, work through a problem real quick, or had specific problems or questions about pieces of the exam? If there was a single problem that I expected people to have difficulty with, it was the third problem, which was the conceptual problem about the picture with the wavelength. And there it was very clear kind of what happened as a routine matter, of course, very understandable and common misconception, but one that should be easy also to see. So you're given this picture and asked some things about this. About this picture of beta functions or beam envelopes, which are these dark black lines, and then 2 particle trajectories moving through this lattice at least. And here it should be clear that the periodicity of this system, you know, goes from this point. Well, when do you repeat that big downward dip? It's here, and then you repeat it again here, and then you repeat it again here, and here, and here. And remember, the periodicity of a system, one period of a lattice, is how it repeats in this beta function, because, you know, the beta function at S plus C is equal to the beta function at S was the definition of periodicity that we originally worked with when we were talking about these systems. So by looking at that, you can see that there are, okay, 5 periods and a little over 300 meters, maybe 320. So the periodicity of the system is somewhere around 64 meters, give or take. It is not, and it is, you know, understandable that we had talked about what these pictures looked like in class, right? That it is not this periodicity. It is not the kind of the long wavelength of the system. In fact, the long wavelength of the system, here you can see that is about, you know, 360 degrees, right? If you see this as a sine wave, that's about 360 degrees going from peak to peak there in about 4.5 cells. Or, you know, repeats of the system. So 360 degrees divided by that ends up being about, what, 80, you know, 80-ish degrees, which is that phase advance per cell that was, you know, down as part C. 81.5 was the number I guesstimated from that picture. So in any event, have a look. There's certainly, you know, I'm available to either talk things over or email me if you have specific questions about this. And we will go from there. But I will post the distribution and things like that online with the class stuff. So we'll have that. Any questions so far? Yeah, Alexandra's question. Where is my exams? I will find it. I am so sorry. So I will dig it up. How's everybody's spring break? I saw Amelia over spring break. She came in and made it up. So I was here on Thursday. So I had a busy week, as always. Wasn't exactly. Enjoy spring break while you got it, because later on in life it's more about scheduling your annual vacation or something like that. So the syllabus has us starting to move past linear optics just a little bit. After we went through all of that stuff and talked all about arrangements of magnets, arrangements of lattices, periodic boundary conditions, these betas, these Courant-Snyder twist parameters, or whatever they're called. So let me go through a couple of slides, and then I'll work from overheads for the rest of it. Because it helps to go back to the animation again. So we had talked quite a lot, you know, about this matrix M, right? About how to derive that for various optical systems, for quadrupoles, for dipoles, for drifts, and how they concatenate them, and how that takes initial particle coordinates, and as the particles go through all these magnets, they come out with final coordinates. They're based, at least on the linear approximation, on these matrices, which is fine. So we concentrate mostly about those matrices. What we haven't really talked about that much is the particles and the beams. And there's a difference between particles and beams in the sense that you pretty much almost never have a beam that is a single particle, right? You have beams and accelerators. You produce things that have lots of electrons or lots of protons, collections or distributions of these things in this phase space, in this XX prime, YY prime space, right? All these different coordinates, all these ensembles. So what we need to do is talk a little bit about what is, you know, not just single particle dynamics, it's called, which is this kind of a picture, but then starting to take a look at what happens if we look at collections of particles. And you can see if we just take the average of all the X's or the average of all the X primes, well, you can just kind of sum them all up over here and over here, and this is linear. And you can kind of get a feeling, okay, that the average or the centroid of this distribution of particles is going to transform the same way by just getting multiplied by an M. By that matrix as it moves through these various magnets. Not so for the higher order moments, for things like the RMS of the distribution, or even if you want to get to skew and kurtosis and stuff like that. So we'll talk first of all a little bit about what are typical particle distributions, what they look like, and then talk a little bit about how you do some calculations and how they relate back to what we've learned so far in terms of transforming things, and try and connect them also to those twist parameters. Early on, I warned you that there are betas and alphas and gammas for both the beam and this collection of magnets. We'll be talking about the beam today. So this is that picture, that kind of animation that I've shown many, many times in this class now, where as you play it forward, I mean, you can see I've put in a distribution of particles, and that distribution of particles is kind of dense in the middle and kind of getting, you know, loose and scattered on the outside. And in fact, this distribution of particles follows very, very loosely a Gaussian distribution. We often choose a Gaussian distribution kind of in big accelerators, like synchrotrons and ring accelerators. The distribution of particles pretty much ends up being Gaussian. Gaussians are great distributions if you're thinking about a bunch of particles that are encountering individual uncorrelated scattering things as they bounce against, you know, residual gas in the vacuum of the beam pipe, or they're diffusing around a large ensemble of things evolving in this stochastic way, generally ends up following a Gaussian distribution. So overall, on average, a Gaussian distribution is a good place to start. Does not mean that by any means, if I take a cathode, if I take a place to originate a beam of electrons by shining a laser on it and getting my beam of electrons out and starting it on its long journey through CBATH or something like that, it ain't going to look anywhere Gaussian, and nowhere close. But for these purposes, the other wonderful thing about Gaussians is they are very easy to manipulate. They have very clear moments, higher order moments, so let's just go with Gaussians for now. So if you take any projection of this, let's say you look at that distribution of particles along the X or the X prime axis, or the Y prime axis here. If you project that down and make a little histogram and fit it, you'll find that it's pretty much a one-dimensional Gaussian. This is a four-dimensional thing, right? Or even in this space, it's a horrible six-dimensional thing. And you can write down equations for n-dimensional Gaussians that are not just one-dimensional Gaussians. So here I've also taken the opportunity to write down what the general n-dimensional Gaussian looks like in a form where you don't just have x squareds and just have x prime squareds and just have y and y prime squareds, but now you can even have, oh my gosh, you can have things in the Gaussian that look like xx prime. If we play this picture just a little bit, that tilt is a correlation between the position and the angle, right? Between x and x prime. That tilt has a term. If I try to write this out as a two-dimensional Gaussian distribution here, we'll genuinely have a term that looks like x times x prime in this broader form, and so with this one as well. And so you can see as particles move through the phase space that we've even seen before, you know, what's happening is that x and x prime are becoming correlated and uncorrelated as the particles roll or rotate through this phase space and move through these magnets. But in general, whenever you think of it in a truly literal fashion, it's the six-dimensional distribution of particles evolving through the set of magnets. And there can be magnets that don't end up just, just coupling. You know, quadrupoles will couple x and x prime, right? Or drifts, couple x and x prime. as particles move shear through this XX prime space or this YY prime space. Solenoids, you guys looked, we looked at a solenoid earlier, you did one for the homework. A solenoid, you actually get a rotation between X and Y in the phase space, and it starts to couple X and Y together. So you get another term in this horrible distribution that is has to do with a real physical rotation rather than this rotation in phase space, which is this XX prime type of rotation. So you can start, you know, another way of thinking of all of these elements is what do the elements do to the distribution of particles in this phase space, and which coordinates do they couple? And things like solenoids couple X and Y and XX prime, or X prime, Y prime together. Other elements will couple other things together as well. A dipole, what's dispersion? Well, dispersion couples momentum, delta, right? If I'm offset in momentum, I end up being offset in position. That's the definition of dispersion. That's another correlation now that you end up with as you go through one of those dipoles. So it really is truly and kind of fundamentally at a deep level a six-dimensional problem. So let's take a, let's draw down some of this and start doodling. Today is the 13th. There we go. I'll try and get a little bigger here for you. So what did I do? I drew, you know, things like XX prime space. And as a distribution of particles in there, I take that distribution and I make a little histogram out of it underneath. And what I see is that, okay, it's got some sort of a Gaussian distribution. And it's also, it turns out it's also kind of got this relatively broad Gaussian distribution. In X prime space. So I can even talk about this thing as having a sigma X and a sigma X prime, right? Those are Gaussian projections of this beam. And as it moves through a phase space, as it rotates, let's say we have now that what's going to happen is, you know, the particles, you know, do this and develop that kind of correlation. If I draw a histogram of this thing, okay, it's got some, you know, broader distribution than it did over here. I didn't draw the distribution very well, and it's also got some other distribution over here that didn't change that much. So this is these beam sizes here, and this is these beam sizes here. So what are sigmas? Okay. Well, Now, it depends on who you talk to, whether you call this the first moment or the second moment, right? It's, in my mind, the zeroth moment is always the centroid, and the first moment is always the this thing. So I'll put quotes around that, moments of the distribution. That is, if I, you know, if I take the RMS of this distribution, so I'm going to sum up now. I'm going to put a 1 over n minus 1. And I'm going to sum up something like, you know, x minus x bar squared. Let's see, RMS, root mean squared, right? So this is the, and then I need to take something like a square root of all of this. So how far am I away from the average? Square that, so I am adding up a bunch of positive numbers, divide by n minus 1. That is something like the RMS. I mean, and this, for a Gaussian, this is really, really, you know, really, really sigma of the Gaussian, right? So the question is, these sigma, you know, these sigma change. As my particles move through my lattice, so the question is, how do they transform? So let's step back a second, because if these are the first moments of the distribution, there's also the zeroth moments of the distribution. And I kind of suppress that a little bit by always drawing these pictures with the center of the distribution at zero. There's no requirement that the center of that distribution of, you know, particles be at zero. If I have a different coordinate system, define a different coordinate system, they're not at zero anymore, for example. So in fact, you know, not only do the zeroth first moments transform, but even, you know, something like I could have a distribution of particles that starts out here, and there's the zeroth moment of the distribution. It's kind of an x bar, you know, x prime bar, the average, where x bar is defined as the, you know, 1 over n of the sum of the x's. And the same with x prime. So, well, okay, over time, you know, this thing, this point here, this centroid, if I move it through a bunch of magnets, L accelerator lattice described by M, what's it going to do? Well, zero goes to zero because it's a linear transformation. Homogeneous linear transformation. Non-zero, kind of by definition, goes to non-zero because it's so that point, you know, is going to move somewhere. This distribution, you know, might end up moving down here and looking like this because everything kind of looks like a rotation in this space. So these things, if they, you know, those start out as one, and now here I've got x bar and x prime bar, but this is a two. This is a different point. These also transform, right? So how do these, you know, means or the first moments? No, sorry, zero. Let's start with that one first. When you say moments, everybody thinks of sigmas. That's why I started up there. But this zeroth moment, this mean of the distribution, you know how this point transforms to this point. How? Okay. Everything is linear. So let's work that out then. Let's see what it looks like. So this is, so I know for each particle, I have, you know, something like an x sub I and an x sub I prime at location 2 is equal to m times x sub I prime at location 1, right? So for each one of the particles in this distribution here, you know, that particle goes there just by multiplying by m. That's the definition of our single particle motion. That's kind of what we meant by this m, by linearizing this motion and describing this motion in this space. So, okay, so I have this for each particle. The definition of the mean is, you know, x bar is defined as the sum, you know, over I, you know, 1 over n times x sub I, right? So what I can do is I can just sum this thing and divide by n. When I sum this thing, I have a sum over I, 1 over n, of each x sub I and x sub I prime. Well, the m doesn't care about the i's, so I can put the sum inside of that. That's 2 and that's 1. Okay. What is this thing? This thing is, you know, the mean. At that point 2 of the distribution. 1 over n times that sum. If I put that sum on each one of these components and just do the math, and the same thing goes here. If I put this over here, I get an m times x sub I, whoops, no i's because I did the sum, x bar, x prime bar, 1. Okay? So the mean of the distribution moves like a single particle. Not terribly surprising and not terribly illuminating either, but absolutely true. And now you can say, though, that by gosh, okay, this only worked because everything is linear and because finding the mean of stuff is just adding it together, which is already perfectly linear as well. And when I start looking at the next moment, which is squared things, that's not linear. That trick ain't going to work so well anymore. The sigmas, the higher order moments, are definitely not going to transform like single particles. So how do I figure out how the sigmas, how these beam sizes move throughout my accelerator lattice? Well, let's do the same thing, but do a little bit of a trick. Okay. So that only worked because in an x prime calculation was linear. And the sigma calculation is not. So what is what are, you know, how do these things get calculated? Okay, it's through some root mean square, right? I wrote the rough equation over here. So let's you know, we already know how the x bars work. So let's just assume x bar is equal to 0, x prime bar is equal to 0, etc., etc. So we don't need to worry about all of the offsets. We know that. That's easy motion. It's linear. It just transforms like the M matrix, so that's fine. So now, the sigma, like for example, sigma x, for example, now is the square root of, let's say, sigma x squared, to get rid of that nasty square root sign. It's 1 over n minus 1 times the sum of x sub I squared. Okay? Assuming that, you know, again, x bar is equal to 0. So what we want to do is we want to write down some equation like this, except now it needs to involve x squareds and x sub I squareds rather than x sub I's. So this is a neat little trick. We know this, x sub I prime 2 is equal to m x sub I 1, x sub I prime 1. Okay, we know that. Take a transpose. So if I take a transpose of that, I get x sub I prime 2. Well, the transpose of two things multiplied together, you flip the order and multiply them together, right? So the transpose of this thing is something like x sub I prime 2 times m transpose, right? So far, so good? Okay, that's linear algebra and how you do the transpose. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply them together in a funny way, in the way that you wouldn't normally expect. Normally, if you multiply this by this, you want to put this in front of this so you can take this across and this down and get a scalar. Nope. That's not what I want to do. I want to do it the other way. And there's nothing preventing you from doing it the other way, as a matter of fact. So I can take, you know, let's call this 1 and call this 2. And instead of 2 times 1, no, you know, that gives you a scalar. That's an unhappy face. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do 1 times 2. Okay? So I'm going to get, on the left-hand side, I've got x sub I and x sub I prime 2 times x sub I prime 2. Okay. So I've got this thing times this thing, 1 times 2. And on the other side, I'm going to have 1 times 2, m. And now I have x sub I prime 2, 1. That should be a 1 there. Times x sub I prime 1, times m transpose. Okay, so far so good. Do this math. Multiply these things out. When you multiply a column vector and a row vector like this out, you get the 2x2 matrix, right? So you end up getting something like, on the left-hand side, x sub I squared, and then you have x sub I primes, and then you have an x sub I prime squared, is equal to M, and then you have this 2x2 matrix, you know, over here too. This is 2. M transpose. Okay. And now I can do all of my sums over I. Because by gosh, you know, my sums over I divided by n minus 1 is just sigmas for those relative coordinates. So by gosh, I can tell now how the beam sizes transport. So this is sigma. The sigma squares go like x of I squares. Has to, because the dimensions, this is dimension of length squared. That better be a dimension of length squared, which is fine. So this is sigma x squared. This is kind of like, it's funny, in the literature you actually look, and people generally, even though it's something squaredish, people call it xx prime. They don't put a squared on it for some reason, because the two coordinates at the bottom kind of already imply that it's squared, at least. And then this is the sigma x prime squared. And now you see exactly how these things transform. It's m times these things, sigma x squared, sigma xx prime, sigma xx prime, times an m transpose. Okay? So this is how the beam size move or change through, you know, magnets. Represented by m. So if you know your magnets, and you know your initial beam sizes, or moments of the distribution, you can figure out what your final moments of the distribution are, and it's still all just linear algebra. When you get it to higher order terms like cubics and higher order moments and stuff like that, this thing becomes, you know, really, really messy. But this is nice and kind of beautiful and relatively straightforward. And it's also, you know, a neat demonstration of this little trick, which is take a transpose and multiply things together and then add them all together in your distributions. You'll see that trick again in some places like solid state physics, where you're looking at distributions of, for example, electrons and metals and stuff like that. And you want to calculate these things, each of these terms here, these off-diagonal terms. These are correlations, right? So if I have a distribution that looks something like this, okay, well here you can pretty much say that xx prime is going to be zero, because there's, if I draw a line, do some sort of a linear fit through this distribution, it's either, you know, kind of either a vertical line or a horizontal line, depending on how I do the fit. However, if I have some distribution of particles in phase space that is at some point looking like this, whoops, not prime. Certainly if I do a linear fit through this distribution, there's a correlation here. And the sigma, if you calculate it at least, it's not going to be zero, right? You're summing together x's times x primes, and they're either positive together or they're negative together. And they still all end up, you know, being positive together. On the other hand, here, kind of all of the negative x's cancel out the positive x's on the x prime sums, because this thing is symmetric, you know, around both of those axes. This is, I had mentioned, this is all in one dimension. This is all just looking at X's, and I only use 2x2 matrices here. Sometimes in real accelerators, you actually have to worry about this matrix as it stands when it comes to, you know, sigma x squared, sigma x x prime, sigma x y, sigma x y prime, whoops, y prime. This thing is symmetric, you can see, obviously. And this is sigma y squared, sigma, sigma x prime squared, sigma y squared, sigma y prime squared. And all of these different kind of off-diagonal correlations that you get, you can actually get correlations just like the solenoid I was talking about before, where now in X and Y space, you end up getting distributions that look kind of like this by Gaussian, except again with a correlation where here sigma XY does not equal zero, for example, in the solenoid. If you ever look in the literature, we won't go into it much in this class, but this type of correlation, once you introduce it, is very hard to get rid of unless you use other specialized magnets, because if you have this correlation tumbling through your phase space, you need something else that creates or destroys that correlation, that changes that correlation to take it back to zero again. In the animation I had before, where I showed that our good old buddy, the particle distribution animation, assuming it comes back. Oh, hello. Right. So this is the XY space, right? X is on the horizontal axis, Y is on the vertical axis. This is what you see if you literally look at the beam as it's moving through the accelerator and hold up a little screen or something like that to see the beam's image there. And you can see that, at least in this lattice, even though there are correlations coming in and out between X and X prime, Y and Y prime, there is no correlation between X and Y. All of these quadrupoles that change the focusing constantly and all of these drifts or dipoles that would change the focusing or bending as well, don't introduce any correlation between X and Y, which means I can't fix it if it's there with those elements either, because they don't have any lever arm on it. What you need is you need quadrupoles that are actually rotated 45 degrees, and quadrupoles that rotate 45 degrees, so-called skew quads, will help fix that kind of a correlation that shows up. So this sort of thing, you know, you can fix it with solenoids or skew quads. What do I mean by a skew quadrupole? A regular quadrupole. Similar to what you did in the exam, has four poles that look like this. This is north, south, north, south. And what you have are, you have field lines now that do these lovely things. Whoops. Yeah, that's right. Right? Field lines go from south to north, and there's the center of the magnet somewhere in the middle. So if I'm a particle that is displaced just horizontally, well, all of the field lines are perpendicular to that, which means if I'm moving in or out of the paper and I do my curl, my if I'm moving in or out of the paper and encounter some of that field, I get a force that is also, you know, in the horizontal direction if I'm displaced horizontally. If I'm displaced vertically, I get a force that is only in the vertical direction, QV cross B, right? However, if I have a skew quad, what I do is I take this thing and I rotate it 45 degrees. See, I can't even draw it, it's so... And then if I rotate it 45 degrees, north, south, north, south, it's still got four poles, so it is still a quadrupole. But now what happens if I'm displaced? If I'm displaced purely horizontally, from the symmetry of this thing, I don't have any field. If I'm displaced pure vertically, from the symmetry of this thing, I don't have any field. It's symmetric around those lines, okay? However, if I'm displaced, you know, somewhere along this axis, you know, what I get is I get a force, you know, along that axis as well. So I can, you know, I can end up, you know, a displacement, let's say more displacement along X and a little bit of displacement along Y, is going to give me a force. Let's say I'm at that point, the force is in that perpendicular direction. I'm displaced a little bit in Y, but quite a lot in X. But because of the curvature of that field line, the force is actually quite a lot in X, but a little bit in Y. And so anything, any particle that's, you know, positive, you know, X or positive Y, you know, both at least, it tends to turn X's into Y's and Y's into X's. It tends to do exactly this thing, which is this kind of fix or adjust this kind of correlation. Correlations are all over the place in this field, interestingly enough. Somebody at the very beginning of this class, not the very beginning, early on when I was back in here, somebody had mentioned twisted photons, right? Twisted photons have a correlation between the photon spin and the photon direction, just like regular spin does as well. You can also have something called a magnetized beam. And this is a beam that has such a strong correlation between X and Y that it looks like the beam, even through regular elements, is kind of doing this spiral motion in real space, kind of like through a solenoid. And this type of beam is actually very, very useful, as we'll talk about later on in the semester, for beam cooling. And it's very, very relevant to what we're doing for the electron-ion collider. So, and all of this, so what we're talking about in all of these things are these off-diagonal elements. A regular beam just has kind of, is block diagonal, just like the quadrupole that you did for the exam was block diagonal. X stays with X, Y stays with Y, and all of this symmetric coupling that you get. This is X, Y, 2. This is the symmetry goes down here, X, Y prime. All of that is zero for regular normal magnets, at least. But for this magnetized beam, it's clearly not. You have this kind of coupling in the real space. Let's see, so there is this matrix. So let me get some nomenclature in. Next class, we're going to talk a little bit about instrumentation. We're going to talk about how we measure some of these things. So how we measure beam sizes, how we measure beam centroids, and how we measure some of the moments of this distribution. That is not a sum sign, that is a capital sigma. This thing is often called, in the literature, the sigma matrix. Okay. Has to do with the first moments of the distribution. And because I boxed it out, you know, this is how the sigma matrix transforms. If you know your lattice elements. The sigma matrix, because it has to do with the beam distribution. Okay, so let's draw one of these beams in XX prime space again. Forget about all those weird XY couplings that I was commenting about, and just go back to nice, normal, what we call decoupled beam. Okay, so we got a distribution of particles here. Remember, we had also drawn some markers and talked about how this distribution related to some things related to emittance. And related to these twist parameters. Where alpha is defined as minus the S derivative of beta divided by 2. And then gamma is defined as 1 plus alpha squared over beta. Okay. So we had drawn some markers, drawn some reference points in here, where, for example, this location, well, what is that? That's kind of the beam size. Because it is the distribution, you know, some size of the beam in the x direction. And what's this thing here? This is kind of the, you know, beam divergence. Because that is the size of the beam in angle. Is it a small beam or a big beam in angle? That's divergence for you. Okay, so the beam size, well, what's the beam size? The beam size, you know, is sigma x. That first moment that we just calculated and talked about how it transformed. So, and we had related this to these other twist parameters at least, not the defines, but just an equal at least, that sigma is equal to the square root of the beta function at that location times that emittance. And notice that this emittance does not vary with my location in the accelerator lattice, right, with S. And this beam divergence here that we had talked about, sigma x prime, ends up being the square root of gamma times epsilon. So the beam divergence and the beam size, I mean, these guys very clearly depend on where you are, right? As I'm going through the lattice, as my particles are moving through the space, right? The beam sizes change. We calculated that. That was this transformation, how the beam sizes change. In this case, the beam size is squared, how they change as you move through the space. Well, these things are related to betas and gammas and epsilons and things like that. If I put these into that sigma matrix, okay, remember that sigma matrix was defined as sigma x squared, sigma xx prime, sigma xx prime, sigma x prime squared, right? Okay, well, I take this, square it, take all of the epsilons out, because each one of these terms will have an epsilon. It turns out that these correlations here just like this is deeply related, the beam size is deeply related to beta, the beam divergence is deeply related to gamma, the beam correlation is deeply related to alpha. And it turns out, if you do all the math and figure things out, this is beta, this is an alpha, this thing is symmetric, so this has got to be an alpha too, and then this thing is a gamma. Remember before where I talked about how betas and gammas and alphas transform through a lattice? Well, here you got it again, except we approached it a completely different way from moments of distributions. This sigma matrix is related to all of these parameterizations for the beam. If I put in my individual M11s and M12s and all of that stuff and multiply this out and do the math, I can get that same equation again. I can get how these transform through the system. So this sigma matrix, though, is really, really useful. I mean, it's fundamentally kind of useful because, as we'll get to the things in the next class, certainly the beam size, sigma x, is a very good observable, right? I can oftentimes find out how big or small the beam is. If I measure the two locations, I can measure the beam divergence, sigma x prime. And then I can start learning things about my accelerator lattice, about my m's, that I didn't necessarily know by looking at how the beam is transforming through that system. So that'll be the subject of the next lecture, at least, talking a little bit about instrumentation, about some hardware, about beam position monitors that measure the centroid of these distribution of charged particles and how they work. I think it's chapter 11 of the book or something like that. We're leaping forward just a little bit. But like I said, second half of the semester is very, we're going to hop around a lot and cover a lot of different little topics. Now that everybody is back, I'm also going to, I got some ideas for orals for the end of the semester assembled, so I'm going to farm those out to everybody as seed ideas. Don't feel like you have to stick to them. If you have something near and dear to your heart that you want to talk about instead, go ahead. But we do need to get those lined up so that you have enough time to work on a 15-minute presentation for the class at the end of the semester. Okay?